So a few announcements. There is a homework that's due this week. I also put up a project for the next, not the project, the next assignment rather. I'll discuss that today. And I have been mentioning the midterm. I finally got a room. It's going to be the adjacent room, COMSAI 142, on November 17th. I put a note on the course webpage. It's going to be an evening exam. Closed book, closed notes. Currently it's scheduled to start at 6:30 because somebody has occupied the room till 6:30. I'm trying to see whether we can actually get the room at 6, in which case we will start at 6. Okay? For now, assume that we can at least start at 6:30 on the 17th. I will send out a sample midterm so you can get a feel for what kind of questions to expect on the exam. So look for that on the course webpage, or rather the course mailing list. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about the programming assignment before I start the lecture itself. Okay, so I have put this up. It's due in about 2.5 weeks. It will build on the first programming assignment that you did. Okay, and it will use several of the concepts that we have covered in class over the last 3 or 4 lectures. Okay, so this is the basic scenario that you have to implement. Okay, so you have again a multi-tier application, the same application as before. There is a front-end tier and there is a back-end database. Okay. In this case, we are going to assume that the front-end is replicated. Okay. In particular, I have kept it simple, just assume 2 replicas of the front end, each of which can talk to the database independently. Okay? Clients can talk to any of the replicas, and they can pick. Okay? And they will do exactly what they were doing before. Okay? So you pick one replica and then it looks like the same system as before, except that there are 2 here, not 1. So that's the first thing. So you have to replicate the front end. And this could be done as simply as just run 2 processes that are running the same code as your front end. Okay, and so long as each of those can talk to the back end, and if you have implemented locking and concurrency in the back end, all this should be, this part should be very straightforward. Okay, straightforward extension of what you've already done. Okay? What you actually need to do is then take this architecture and implement 2 things, clock synchronization and locking, distributed locking. So we will use the algorithms that we have studied in class to implement both of these. Okay? So assume that these 3 processes, okay, we'll just number them 1, 2, 3, run a leader election algorithm. Okay? You can implement any one. I suggested on the web page that implement the ring-based leader election algorithm. So they elect a leader. Okay? Among themselves, and that leader is going to be the coordinator both for the clock synchronization and the locking protocol. Okay. So once you pick the leader, then that becomes the time server, okay, for the clock synchronization algorithm, and you are required to implement the Berkeley clock synchronization algorithm. Okay. If you remember the Berkeley algorithm, every so often each of these, the time server will go and poll all of the processes. It will get the times on those processes, compute the average, and then ask all the other processes to adjust their clocks so that they all advance to the average. Okay. Now, in reality, because you are not going to be privileged on the machine, these processes will not actually change the real-time clock value on the machine. Instead, what they will do is they will actually keep an offset delta, which is the offset by which they should have modified the clock value. And then you just write a wrapper function which greets the system time, adjusts it by this clock offset and returns it. Okay, this simulates the clock synchronization algorithm without actually changing the time on the machine. Okay, so all you will do is you will keep this offset and then modify the clock value. You have a question?
We'll have to do all this in the local system.
This should preferably be on more than one machine. Otherwise, all these values are going to be identical. Right? There's only one clock. At least 2 machines. Okay. For implementation, you can use 1, but you could run the code, for instance, on the EdLab machine. There are 10 of them. Just to show the final result that these values are different. Otherwise, they will all have this. The code should work obviously on a single machine, but they will all have the same clock. In fact, this clock skew will always be zero, because it's the same clock, you cannot do anything about it. Okay? So that's the first thing. So you will implement leader election and just implement a simple Berkeley clock synchronization algorithm. So what this does in particular is it allows these two processes, which could be running on arbitrary machines, to have synchronized clocks. And as a result, whenever clients send post messages, these messages are timestamped here, these timestamps actually make some sense. Otherwise, if the clocks are not synchronized, the timestamps will not be comparable. Okay, so then if the clocks are synchronized, then you will have synchronized timestamps. So when you insert these post messages here, okay, they will actually be in order. Is that clear? Because you have to remember that in the post you have to timestamp each message and then put it in the database. Okay, so each message has a timestamp. So you will assign timestamps at the front end here, but you will use clock synchronization to get some notion, some sense of consistency. Is this clear? Yes.
In practice, would you have the back end choose the timestamp to avoid this sort of problem?
In practice, would you have the back end choose the timestamp? You could have the back end choose the timestamp. Yes, so that could be done. Okay? But there are many applications where here we have a single backend. Okay? Suppose that the backend was a replicated database, then who would choose the timestamp for you? Okay? Just for simplicity, I have not asked you to replicate it. But if everything was replicated, there is no single authority. The authority is the time server. So the time server is allowing you to synchronize your clock, so you choose the timestamps in a consistent manner. But here, one could have simplified it that way. Okay, but we are requiring that you actually still implement the time synchronization. Is this clear? This part of the okay. So that's part one of the project. Okay, implement simple clock synchronization. Okay. Part two is we will actually implement locks, a distributed lock. Okay. So you probably have used some lock mechanism that's either available to you in the language. But let's say you use Java, you may have used synchronized feature to implement it, or you may have used POSIX locks in part 1. Okay? In part 2, you actually have to implement your own locking. In particular, it has to be a distributed locking mechanism. Okay? If you remember what we discussed in class, essentially in a distributed locking mechanism, there is a coordinator. Okay? You have to send your request lock and release lock messages to the coordinator. Okay. The coordinator just maintains all of these messages in a FIFO order and grants locks one at a time. Okay, so you implement a distributed coordinator. In this case, it's the same process that was chosen as the leader. Okay. So before you do either a post or a retrieve, okay, you have to first send a message to the coordinator saying, I want the lock. Okay. At some later point, the coordinator will send a message saying, you have the lock. Until then, the client would have to block. Okay. Or not the client, the time server, not the time server, the front end process would have to block. Okay. And once you have the lock, then you can do whatever operation you want to do on the database and release the lock. Okay. By release, you send back a message to the coordinator saying we release the lock. Okay. Is that clear? The only wrinkle here is for efficiency, you will require that the lock be what is called a read-write lock rather than a normal lock that is just going to do an acquire and release. In a read-write lock, what happens is multiple readers are allowed to read the hold the read lock on the database at the same time. Okay? So, whenever a process requires a lock, you have to request a lock in a read mode or a write mode. Okay? It's the same lock, but rather than saying I just want the lock, you specify I want the lock in a read mode or I want the lock in a write mode. If you request a lock in the read mode, okay, and you get it, then it is possible that other readers are also given the read lock, because you are specified that you are only going to read, not modify the data structure, in this case is the database. Okay? Multiple readers are allowed to hold the lock concurrently in a read-write lock. Okay? On the other hand, if you request the lock in write mode, then only that process is allowed to hold the lock. So then it becomes like a normal lock. Now, no one else can access that database when you hold the lock. Okay. So you have to implement a simple read-write protocol. So what this would do is you will send a message to the coordinator requesting the lock either in read mode or write mode. Okay. If you request it in read mode and there are no other writers in the system at this point, you will be given the lock. And multiple read requests will be granted, read acquires will be granted concurrently. If you request the lock in write mode, at that point you have to wait for all the readers to finish. Okay. and then you are given the lock, and until you release it, everyone else is blocked. Okay, this is what a simple read-write lock does. Okay, so all we are requiring is you implement the read-write locking using your coordinator rather than just doing an acquire or release. So what this will allow you to do is multiple retrieves should be handled concurrently, because retrieves are just reads on the database. They are not modifying the database. So your retrieve message will require a read lock. Okay? Post is actually going to modify the database. So before you do a post, you acquire a write lock. Okay? But before you do a retrieve, you can have read lock, and multiple retrieves can happen in parallel. Okay? That's all we need to do, okay, in terms of the read write locks. Yes, there's a question.
Java implementation of a read write lock, do we have to implement it ourselves?
Yes. So you cannot use any implementation. You have to implement your own read-write lock, and it has to be a distributed lock. That's the most important part, not a centralized lock. So in particular, you have to implement the distributed locking mechanism we have discussed in class, where there's a coordinator. Okay? Anyone who wants a lock contacts the coordinator saying, I want a lock. Okay? All that the coordinator does is ensure that only one writer can hold a lock at any time, or multiple readers and no writers can hold. So it just needs to enforce this mechanism. Okay, so you are not going to use an existing implementation. You are going to implement distributed locking here. Okay? Are there any questions on what needs to be done? Other than this, you should reuse as much of your code as possible from project one. Hopefully you made reasonable design decisions that you can extend the code in this fashion. Okay, because the rest of the assignment is basically the same. You are going to use a system you built and add these two features, clock synchronization and read-write locking. Yes, sir.
Are we going to get our first funds graded before this one's due?
Okay. So I will make sure that that gets handed out ASAP. Okay. So hopefully this week itself. So you can have plenty of time to see what you did and how to extend that. Okay. As always, you can work in groups of two. Okay. I already mentioned that subsequent projects will require a little more effort than the first one. So feel free to team up if you haven't already done so. Yeah, that's perfectly fine to come up with some understanding of division of labor. Yes.
As far as the grading goes, though, it's mainly focused on that, right? Not what the previous one.
Yes. The grading is going to be focused on making sure you can elect a leader, making sure that your clock synchronization does what it's supposed to do, and read-write locks. Okay. The first project will grade, rather the first assignment will grade what you did there. Here we will not worry about what you did in the first assignment. Okay? Noted. Any other questions? So go to take a look at what's on the web page. If you have questions, come back, ask before you get started. And again, I would recommend that you start early. Don't start late, because some of this might take a little time and effort to implement. Okay, so the project is due a week before the midterm. Okay, so then once the project is done, you'll have a whole week to just focus on the midterm. Nothing else will be due in that week. The midterm is still 3 weeks away. Okay. The other thing I wanted to mention is only lectures 1 through 13, everything we have covered until last class is what is going to be covered on the midterm. Okay. What I am doing from today onwards is not going to be on the midterm. It will be part of the final, but you don't have to worry about it for the midterm. So first 6 chapters of the book, essentially, chapters 1 through 6, yeah, is what's the material for the midterm. Although the midterm is a couple of weeks away, I am not going to include the material we cover from today on. Okay. Just to keep the material manageable. Okay, so with that, let's move on and come back to where we were. So just a quick recap. Last time we talked about leader election, distributed mutual exclusion. Okay, both of those things are actually going to be important for your assignment. Okay, so if you haven't really understood some aspects of it, go review that material, go read the book, and come and ask questions. We are happy to answer any questions or clarify any aspect of the material. So what I'm going to do today is actually start a new chapter. Okay, which is on distributed transactions. Okay. Some of this material is no longer present in the new version of the book. I will make some photocopied material available. Yeah, because I think they have been modifying the material. But let me present the concept, and then next time I'll bring some photocopies with me. So this is the topic of distributed transaction. Okay, so first I will introduce the notion of what a transaction is. If you have taken any class in databases, you should have some idea what a transaction is. But I will review what a transaction is, I will review properties that a transactional system provides, and then we will talk about how to implement a distributed transactional system. That's really the goal of what we want to achieve here today. Okay. So what are transactions? So transactions are essentially mechanisms that provide you a high level mechanism to do some operations in an atomic manner. In other words, they allow you atomic processing. Okay? They have their origins in databases, but there will be many distributed applications where you just need the transactional aspects. Okay? Which any database provides, but database provides other things also. But what we are really interested in is just the transactional aspect here. Okay? So to understand why you need atomicity, okay, here's an example from a banking system. Okay? And so what you have here is a simple bank database that has three accounts, A, B, and C. Okay? And the balances are shown here, okay, $100, $200, and $300. Okay? Now you want to process some operations on these on this database. In particular, client 1 wants to transfer $4 from A to B, account A to B, and client 2 wants to transfer $3 from C to B. Okay? Essentially, what is happening is $7 have to get transferred to account B. Okay? Now, let's assume that these two clients are actually executing in parallel. The way the clients would execute is basically they would, if you want to transfer $4 from A to B, you have to read the account balance of A, okay? Deduct $4 from that and update A. You have to read the account dollar of B, okay? Add $4 and update that account balance. That's what your transaction, or not a transaction, but that's what client one has to do. And these are the read and write operations that are shown here. You read the account balance of A, it's 100, you write, update it. Okay? You deducted 4, read B and you update it. Okay, and the same thing has to be done by client 2, okay, for account C and B. Okay. Now, if these two clients are executing in parallel, these reads and writes are going to get interleaved, okay, within the database. Okay. So, in particular, you might get this interleaving of reads and writes. So, this is time. Okay. At each time step, you are shown which operation is actually taking place. So, here you read A, you update A. Then next, your time step 3, you read C and you update C. Okay. So far everything is fine. Okay. Now you read B and you read $200. Okay. And then client 2 goes next, and client 2 also reads the account balance B. Okay. And then client 2 goes and updates it. Okay. So he's added $3 to B. And then client B goes and updates it. Okay. You added $4. Okay. So what you have at the end of these two, of this interleaving, is you have deducted $4 from A, you have deducted $3 from client C, but what has actually appeared in client B's account is only $4. You know, what has happened here is this write has overwritten that write. Okay, so here you updated it, you did 203, so you should really have done something that would have increased the balance to 207. So $7 are getting transferred. But because of this interleaving, the reads and writes got interleaved. Okay? You got into this problem. Okay? This is the same reason why you at least need to protect any shared data structure with a lock. Okay? Here there was no lock. So client 1 and 2 were basically accessing these data structures concurrently without any locking whatsoever. Okay? So transactions provide you the notion of locking, but they do something more than that. So at the very least, it should be clear that any concurrent access require locking for consistency, but transactions do more than that, as we will see. Okay, so results can be inconsistent unless certain properties are imposed on the access, and we will see what those properties are. Okay, so transactions give you what are called ACID properties. Okay, they give you atomicity, okay, which is all or nothing. Okay, so what that means is either you get the results of your system are left in a state that looks as if the entire set of operations succeeded atomically, or none at all. You will never see a scenario where some of these reads and writes succeeded and some others didn't. Okay, so the whole sequence of operations has succeeded, meaning you deducted from A and added to B, or nothing. Okay, so you are left the system as is. You can't deduct some money from A and then it disappears into thin air and doesn't appear in B. So that's not a consistent state. So you get atomicity. Okay? You also get what is called consistency. Okay, so A in acid is atomicity, C is consistency, I is isolation, and D is durability. Okay? So consistency says that the transactional system takes the system from one consistent state to another. If you are consistent, okay, and you execute a transaction, the transaction guarantees that the subsequent state is also consistent. Okay? So this here is an example of an inconsistent state, where the system started in a consistent state here, and now you have 96, 297 and 204. This is an inconsistent state. Okay? So this is not satisfying the consistency requirement of transactions. Okay? Isolation basically says that, isolation is also referred to as serializability. Okay? Says that immediate effects are not visible to others. Okay? And it also appears as if all the transactions, okay, executed sequentially. Okay, rather, even though they are executing in parallel, the state of the system is such that it appears that the transactions executed sequentially. Okay? And durability, which is also referred to as the commit part of the transaction, says that the changes are permanent once the transaction completes. Okay? Once the transaction finishes and commits, then the state of the system is permanent. You cannot change it. Okay? But while the transaction is executing, what is also corollary here is while the transaction is executing, you can actually stop the transaction and roll back the state, and you will actually go back to the state of the system that existed before the transaction began. Okay? So any point in the execution of the transaction, you can stop, you can abort the transaction and roll it back. But once the transaction finishes successfully and it commits, then your changes become permanent, then you cannot modify. Okay? So these are referred to as ACID properties. Okay? Any database system that has transactional semantics or provides transactional semantics will give you ACID properties. Okay, let's just review. So here's an example of how the two clients should have executed. Okay, it doesn't matter in which order. Here what you have shown is it should appear as if client 1 executed first and client 2 executed next, or vice versa. Okay? Both of those are acceptable orderings for us. Okay? Even though, remember that even though actually the clients are executing in parallel and the reads and writes may be interleaved, what you want is for the system to behave as if each one went sequentially one after another. Okay, even though they are executing in parallel. So this should be what the end result is. Okay, but the actual execution will be in parallel. Is that clear? Okay. So those are ACID properties. So let's now look at how a transactional system implements this notion of a transaction, then we'll talk about distributed transactions. So here is basically, here are some primitives that a transactional system provides. So if you want to protect any piece of code, okay, within a transaction, then you have to enclose it, a begin and the end transaction around it. Okay, so anything between a begin and end transaction is going to get your transactional semantic, which means either all of those statements execute successfully or none at all. Okay, if you basically kill the transaction before it finishes, then any modification that has been done has to be rolled back. So then you have abort transaction, which allows you to kill the transaction, restore old values. So then within a transaction, you are actually going to do reads and writes. You will modify some state of the system, okay, using read and write operation. So here's an example of a transactional system. Okay, and here what you are trying to do is book a flight, okay, from point A to point B using a sequence of hops. Okay, and you want the whole operation to succeed only if you actually can reserve all segments of the flight. You don't want a scenario where you reserve two segments and you do not get a reservation, a confirmed booking on some other segment. Okay? So what this is saying is, you say you reserve the New York to Paris segment, and if that is full, then you abort the transaction. Okay? But if it succeeds, then you go to the next statement and say reserve the Paris to Athens segment, and then you say Athens to Delhi segment. If all of these succeed, then you will hit the end transaction. If any one of them fail, you call abort transaction and you stop. Okay, and then you roll back any reservation. So if this reserve function actually modifies the a database, okay, in particular the airline reservation system, okay, it goes and actually makes a booking. So if you abort it, then you have to sort of undo the effects of that booking. Okay, but if all of them succeed, then you have successfully reserved the entire flights, okay, all segments of that flight. It's just an example of how one might use these primitives. Okay. The actual reads and write operations will be within the reserve methods, which has not been shown here. Okay. this basic concept clear, we'll talk about how to go about implementing a transactional system. These are just concepts. So now let's look at what is a distributed transaction. Okay? So to understand that, let me first introduce this notion of what's called a nested transaction. Okay? A nested transaction is one where one transaction is nested or enclosed in another transaction. Okay? So you could think of, in the previous example, think of this. This might be a nested transaction where you have begin transaction and end transaction, and each of this could be a separate transaction if these hops are on different airlines, for instance. Okay, you use airline A to go from A to B. So you have to basically use a transaction to make a booking on that airline. Okay? And then B to C may be another airline. Okay? And then you have to use another transaction to make a booking on this other reservation system. Okay? So you have one transaction nested in another. So here is another example being shown here. You have airline database and a hotel database. So you want to book a ticket, airline ticket, and you want to make a hotel booking. So you want both of those to succeed. You don't want to land up in a place without a hotel or get a hotel and not a flight. So you basically enclose the entire reservation in a large transaction. Then you make two separate transactions, one to book an airline, make an airline reservation, one to book a hotel. This is referred to as a nested transaction, where one transaction or a sub-transaction is nested in another. Okay? And in a nested transaction, typically each transaction might access a different database. Okay? Here on the other right side is shown what is showing a distributed transaction. Okay? So the difference between a nested transaction and a distributed transaction is one where the database itself is distributed. It may, here there are two independent databases. Here it's one logical database, but because this database is large, it is distributed on multiple machines. Yeah? But it's acting as a logical data, single database. Okay? So when you do your transactions might hit different parts of the database. So each sub-transaction may be accessing a different replica, okay? Each of which may be storing a different set of records. Okay? So for instance, you might have single airline might have one replica that handles, let's say, domestic flights and one that handles its international flights. Okay. If you want to go from point A to point B, you might have to take a domestic hop and then make an international hop. Okay. This would require, and this is one logical database as far as all other users are concerned, this is the airline reservation system. Okay. The way the airline has maintained it is basically independent, logical, or other distributed database. So each of those sub-transactions hit a separate part of the database. So these are two physically separate parts of the same database is the way to think about it. Okay? So that's the difference between what is a distributed versus a nested transaction. Each of those will have sub-transactions, but what the sub-transactions are doing are different. Here each sub-transaction accesses an independent database. Here a sub-transaction accesses a different part of the same database. Okay? Is that clear? Yes, there's a question there.
Database to be, for it to be a nested transaction, does it have to be different databases? Or can it?
No. So this is just presenting the example of a distributed transaction or a nested transaction from a database perspective. But really, as far as we are concerned, we could write a transaction system without even a database. So all we require for a nested transaction is you have a begin transaction and an end transaction. And within this begin, there's another begin and an end. That's all. So what you are basically requiring is these statements execute atomically. And then all of this statement and this transaction also execute atomically. That's all we are trying to do. Okay? Any other questions? And you can have arbitrary levels of nesting. Okay, here we have only shown one level of nesting. But this could be arbitrary in how the transactional system works. Okay, so now we will talk about how to go about implementing a transactional system. We'll start with a centralized implementation. Then we'll see how do you go about making it a distributed implementation. Okay. So what do you do? So there are two ways we can do or implement a transactional system, using this notion of a private workspace and using the notion of a log. Okay. So what happens in a private workspace is you make the transaction think that it actually has a private copy of the entire database that it is free to modify. Okay? While it is modifying this private copy, the changes are not visible to the rest of the system. Okay, so you essentially assume that you make a logical copy of the whole database and you work off this local copy. Okay, and when you're done, when it's time to commit, you basically go and update the real database with all the changes you made. Okay, that's the basic idea behind a private workspace. So each transaction gets its own private workspace that it can modify in any way it wants. Okay, and when the transaction is ready to commit, you go and commit the changes back to the real database. Okay. So here is an example. Okay, so this is basically your database. These could be records. Okay, there are many records in your database, and this is the index that points to these records. Okay. So now a transaction starts up, so that transaction basically gets its own copy of the records. Okay, that it can modify. So in this case, probably you cannot see this, but you have modified record 3, so it becomes 3 prime. So there's a new copy of 3 prime. It actually inserts a record. Okay, in this case, because you only had 0, 1 and 2, new record got inserted, it's here. At this point, it is not visible to the rest of the database. Any other transaction that's executing doesn't know about the presence of record 3. Okay. But at some later point, when you commit, then this 3 is actually, the presence of 3 is made visible, and the original index is updated, so now you can see that 3 got inserted into the database. Okay. Now, clearly it is not possible, if your database is large, it's not going to be efficient to make a real copy of the whole database every time a transaction starts. Okay? That is just way too much overhead. So what you instead do is you use what is called copy and write, and that's what is, these are the two bullets here, which says you can optimize this notion of making a logical copy using this notion of copy and write. So what actually happens is you pretend to give a copy of the whole database to this system. Okay. But you actually give a copy of the actual database. I mean, you allow it to access the real database, and only when you make a modification, you actually make a copy. Because whenever, that's what a copy on write means. A copy on write says you basically have two objects that are accessing the same physical object. Okay, they look like two independent objects. But when one of them makes a change, only then do you make a copy. Okay. This is also referred to as lazy copying. Okay. So in the normal case, if you do eager copying, you actually make a copy of all of the data, okay, and you give it to the transaction in the private workspace. Okay, but that has too much overhead. So you defer the copying only if you need. So that's copy on write. So, and when do you need to make a copy is when you actually write. Okay, unless you modify something, there's no reason to make a copy because the values of the two records are going to be the same. Only when you modify have you actually changed the state of the database. At that point, you can make a copy of only what you have modified and nothing else. Okay, is that clear? So this is also referred to copy and write or cost. So this is a optimization that is used in many systems, okay? Also in databases. Anytime you want to make copies, you want to reduce the overhead of copying, you use this optimization called copy and write, which defers the actual copies to only those parts of the system that have been modified, have been written to. Any questions on this? Private workspaces. Is this clear what we just said? Okay. So the second option to implement your transactional system is called a write ahead log. So here we are not going to make any copies for the system. Okay. Rather, we will allow each transaction to go ahead and make changes in place. Okay. So you will start modifying the database as the transaction is executing. Okay. And then what we will do we'll keep a copy of all the a list of all the changes you have made to the database in a special file called a log. Okay? This is referred to as a write ahead log. So prior to making each change, you have to write an entry to this log saying this is the change I am going to make. Okay? And then what you do is when it's time to commit, you say, is it okay for me to commit or should this transaction be aborted? If it's okay for me to commit, there is nothing to do because I've already made the changes I need to in the database. If for any reason I want to abort the transaction, at that point I need to go and roll back the changes I have made. And this is where you are going to use the log and say these were the changes I made, I need to roll all of them back. So you go and undo all of those changes. So the log actually has to keep track of what changes you have made and how you can undo them. And I'll show you an example of how this works. So essentially that's what you do. So if you abort, you read the log records and you undo changes. This is called a rollback of your transaction. Okay? And the logs can be used to rerun the transaction if you want, if something fails. Okay? So this is basically this notion of right headlock. So one more thing I want to mention is that both of these workspaces and right headlocks work regardless of whether your transactional system is centralized or distributed. And only thing you need to ensure is commits have to be atomic. Okay, in order to preserve this asset properties, you want to ensure that commits are atomic. And we'll come back to transactions that conflict and how to roll them back and whatnot. Okay, yes, question. So if you think of a distributed, let's just erase this. The question is, how can workspaces be used in a distributed database? This is a picture that I have in a few slides. But what's a distributed database? It's a database where think of a database as a file, essentially, that has records. In a distributed database, this file is chopped up into pieces and spread across multiple disks, each of which is on a different machine. That's all a distributed database is. So what do you do when you have a local workspace is you basically assume that you have a copy of the entire distributed database, logically. So in this case, you make a copy of this file and this file, and your transaction is going to access these two. Okay? And when time to commit, you will take the changes here and propagate them back to the real database. You will take the changes here and propagate them back. That's all. Okay? So you will basically, in other words, this is a single disk. You have multiple disks in a distributed database. You do the same thing on each disk where the database resides. And that's all you have to do. Yes, multiple writes on multiple machines. Any questions? Other questions on this? Okay, so let's look at an example of a write-ahead log and what this does. Okay? Here's a very simple transaction. Okay, we'll assume that you have two variables, X and Y. It could be stored in a database. Okay? And what you are doing is you are basically modifying the values of X and Y, and you are enclosing these operations within a transaction. Okay, so you basically increment X by 1, you increment Y by 2, and then you set X as Y times Y. Okay, very simple. So now what? So initially the values of X and Y are 0. Okay, so now when in the right-hand log, when this transaction begins, you are actually going to go and start modifying the real values of X and Y. If this was a private workspace, you would have made a copy of X, copy of Y, modified that within the transaction, and at the end transaction, if you are successful, you propagate those changes back. In write-ahead log, you will modify those variables in place. Okay? So you will go do X equals to X plus 1. So then in that log, you are going to write, I modified X. Before modifying it, the value was 0. After modifying it, the value was 1. Okay, this is the entry you are going to write into the log. Okay. And then you do the same thing to Y. So you basically say before modifying it, Y was 0. After executing the statement, the value of Y is 2. Okay. And then you do the same thing for X, saying it's now 1 and you modified it to 4. Okay. At the end of this sequence of operations, if you want to do an end transaction and you commit, then you have to do nothing. At this point, the values of X and Y are what they should be. On the other hand, if this transaction needs to abort for any reason, okay, then you have to roll all of these back and restore the original values of X and Y. Okay? At this point, at the end transaction time, the value of Y is 2 and the value of X is 4. You need to undo it and go back to 0, 0. Okay? And the way you will do this is that you will actually go through the log backwards, okay, and restore each value. So you will replay this statement in reverse. So you will say, take the value of X, which is 4, and make it 1. Then you will go to the previous statement. Take the value of Y, which is 2, and make it 0. Okay. You will go back here saying, take the value of Y, which is 1, make it 0. So once you have replayed the log in backwards, you will basically end up with 0, 0 again, okay, which is what the original value was. So you have essentially restored the state of the system as it was before the transaction began. Okay, and as I said, if you have to commit successfully, nothing needs to be done. So log entries will stay in the log. You will just write a record saying transaction committed. And then you can at some later point erase these entries from the log. Yes.
Why couldn't you just start from the beginning and look for the initial values of each?
Yes, so good question. So the question is, why should you replay the log backwards? Why could you not look at all the entries and just see what are the most sort of the first entry is that modified that and restore it. That's an optimization you could do. Okay, that requires you to search through entries and see where. So this could be a large transaction that's modifying lots of different records. Okay. Just doing it backwards is mechanical. It just achieves the same effect. Okay, you may be doing more changes than you need, as you just pointed out. In particular, X get modified two times. If you had looked at this two entries and said this is the first entry, this entry is going to get overwritten by that, because you first change it from 4 to 1 and then 1 to 0. If you had done the smart thing, you would have just replayed this thing. Okay? One could certainly do though, and there are optimizations like that you could perform. This is a simple sort of dumb approach that achieves the same thing. Just play the log backwards and you are done. Okay? Any other questions? Is this clear? What is the right head log? Okay. So now assume that we know how to implement a simple transactional system using either a private workspace or a transactional log. Thus far we have not talked about any notion of locking. When do you commit? When do you abort? None of that has been discussed. All you have said is you want to implement a transactional system. What are two mechanisms? You can use a private workspace. You can use a write-ahead logs. Okay. But if you go back to our original set of properties, we want all of these properties. Okay. Thus far, just having a private workspace doesn't give you any of those. Okay. It probably only gives you durability, which says once you commit and you your changes are permanent, or you can roll back. But we haven't done any of the other ones. So where does the locking part come in? How do you ensure serializability? Or none of that has been discussed. Okay, so let's not start talking about each of those other things. Okay. So first of those is going to be concurrency control. Okay. So goal of concurrency control is to allow multiple transactions to execute simultaneously. Okay, so multiple transactions are running, they are all modifying the state of the database. Okay. And you want the collection of manipulated data to be left in a consistent state. Okay. One simple way of ensuring consistency is protect the whole database with a global lock. Okay. Before any transaction begins, you get a global lock. You lock the whole database. Okay. Only this transaction can run, make whatever changes you want, release the lock. That is what you did for your programming assignment. You lock the whole database. Okay. And you inserted entries, you read entries, and so on. Okay. But if you do that, then only one transaction can run at a time. Okay. In large systems, you may have thousands of transactions all wanting to execute at the same time. Okay. Think of an airline reservation system. There may be hundreds or thousands of customers who want to make a reservation, trying to make a booking. If you say, okay, stand in queue and we'll serve you one at a time, you'll probably wait several hours before you get a chance to make a reservation. You don't want that. You want all of these operations to execute concurrently. And yet, you want the database to be left in a state as if each of these were executing sequentially, only one at a time. So you want to simulate the execution of a single transaction at a time and yet allow multiple of them to run. Yeah, that's what concurrency control allows you to do. So what it does is it figures out when transactions run concurrently whether some transaction is doing something it shouldn't and should be aborted or blocked until it gets the right lock or right privileges and so on. Okay. So that's the goal. Okay, so we want to achieve consistency by ensuring that data items are accessed in a specific order. And the final result should be as if each transaction ran sequentially. Okay, this gives you the serializability property of asset properties. Okay, so now we haven't said how to do it. This is just what the problem is. Okay, so now how do you do concurrency control? So here is the implementation. This is not the algorithm, but this is how you would actually implement concurrency control in your transactional system. So there are three entities that are mentioned here. There's a transaction manager, there's a scheduler, and there's a data manager. Transaction manager looks at the begin transaction, end transaction. It keeps track of when a transaction began, when the transaction ended, and so on. And then whenever there are read and write operations within a transaction that make read or write records of your database or your system, then you basically send request to the scheduler saying I need to read this, I need to write this. The scheduler will actually get locks for you and release locks for you. Okay. The important thing to remember here is that you aren't protecting the whole database with a single lock. You can actually implement much more fine-grained locking. In particular, you can have a lock per record. Okay. So you can only grab a lock on a record and modify just that record. So then multiple transactions can execute in parallel. If each of them is looking at a different record, then there is nothing for them to worry about. Okay, they can all proceed in parallel. Only when they are doing something that conflicts, which is they are accessing the same record, do you need to worry about something. So this is how we are going to achieve concurrency, by ensuring that locking is being done at a much more fine grain than at a whole database level or a table level. Okay. So the scheduler is the part where the intelligence lies. It figures out what locks need to be acquired, what locks need to be released. And the data manager is just taking the read and write operation and just executing. It's either reading from the files or writing to the files. Okay. So before you do this, you have to ensure that you have the right locks. Okay. And then this is doing, this is taking care of whether the transaction, when a transaction begins, when it ends, should it commit, should it roll back, all of that is being handled at this level. And here is a distributed implementation of the same thing. Okay. So now your database is split across multiple machines, A, B, and C. Okay. So same concurrency control mechanism as a single transactional manager. All transactions come in here, okay, but there is a scheduler and there's a data manager for each machine. Okay. So this implements locking for all the records that are on this machine, and this implements reads and write operations for all the records that are on this machine, and same for each of those machines. Now there are arrows being shown here, dotted arrows, which show that they may have to communicate. Okay. Where this scheduler may need to know about some locks that are granted here and data objects that reside there for consistency reason. Okay. So we look at actual implementations of what's happening in here, okay, in the next slide. But that's why there are those dotted arrows, okay, because there may be coordination that's necessary. Okay, so now let's talk about concurrency control sort of fundamental. So we'll start with this notion again of serializability. With an example, just try to understand what works and what doesn't work. So here we have three transactions now. Okay. They are executing in parallel. Okay. So they are basically, each of them is modifying just one variable X. And we want to understand what order of operations will we accept as consistent and which ones are not consistent. Okay. And what is shown in this table are arbitrary interleavings of those six statements. Okay, so there are six statements here, each of them has two. So this is showing the order in which those statements executed. This is showing another order and this is showing a third order. Okay. The question is, which of those will we accept as legal, okay, from a serializability standpoint, and which one is not legal. Okay. So what does legal mean? Any end result, okay, where you could say that this is an ordering, sequential ordering of transaction. If the transaction is actually executed in this order, the database would be left in that state, will be accepted as legal. Okay. So take any arbitrary ordering, saying that this one goes first, then that goes next, and that goes third. Okay. In your logical ordering, in reality they are executing in parallel. But if you could construct an ordering and say if they actually executed in this order, this is the state we would be left with, then we accept it as legal. Okay. If you cannot come up with such ordering, then we will say that this is not legal. Okay. Now to understand, for this example actually happens to be very simple. Okay. To understand which of the, so what are the possible states that the database could be left in at the end of these three transactions? Let's try to just look at those statements and see. Yes. X equals 1, 2, or 3. So what each transaction is doing is first erases what the previous transaction, it resets the value to 0. And then it is just incrementing it by 1, 2, or 3. So essentially the transaction that runs last is the one that is going to leave the value of X in a certain state. Because any other transaction that went before it, its effects are wiped down. Okay, so assume that this one went last in some ordering. Whatever the other two transactions, it first resets the value of X to 0 and then it sets it to 3. So at the end of this, 3 is what the value of X is going to be. Okay? So we will accept any ordering, okay, where you basically have either the value of X is 1, 2 or 3. Okay? The value of X is 1, what you know is that this transaction executed last in this sequential ordering. Okay? Other two could have executed in an arbitrary order. The value of X is 2 at the end of this sequence of transaction, then you know this one went last and the other two could have gone in any order, you don't care here. Okay? And if it's three, that one went last. Okay? So here are this interleaving, and what you can see, all you have to do for these sequences is to just look at the last statement, last few statements. So in this case, the value of x is 0 and then you set it to 3. This is legal because at the end of this, your value of x is 3. You do know of an ordering where you could execute them sequentially and be left with a result where x equals 3. Okay? Here, again, the value of x is 3. So you will accept this. Okay? Here, the value of x is 5. Yeah, because you have x equals 0, then x becomes 2 and x becomes 5. So if you are asked, saying, is there any sequential ordering of this transaction where you will get a result x equals 5, there is no such ordering. Okay? So if you interleave those statements and you are left with this ordering, then you say that this is not serializable. So you will not accept this. The transactions have to be rolled back because this is not consistent. Okay? Is that clear? Okay, so here is another thing to keep in mind. In this two schedule, what has happened is, so here you actually have x0 and x1, so this one goes first. This is actually executing sequentially. Then these two go next and this one goes in last. Here there is some interleaving between the first two. Okay, so x equals 0, x equals 0, you have x equals 1, and then you go to 2, and then you do this. So intermediate value, so here x has gone to 1 and then x has gone to 3. Okay. If there are only these two transactions, this wouldn't be a valid interleaving. Okay? But all we care about is the end result. In this case, the state system has actually gone into an intermediate state that you will actually not have accepted as consistent. But because the final state is consistent, you will still accept this interleaving. Okay? Because in particular, what has happened here is this transaction is actually modifying the state of that transaction rather than resetting the value to zero first. Okay? So this is something to keep in mind. Okay. Now, this is just an example. We still don't know how to check automatically to say will we accept some result or not. Okay, so basically we want to properly schedule conflicting operations, and conflicts are possible if in some operation you have what's called a read-write conflict or a write-write conflict. If there is some transaction has read a value and some other transaction is modifying it while this has read it, then that's called a read-write conflict. A transaction is reading a record and some other transaction is writing to it at the same time. That's a conflict, shouldn't be allowed. Okay? A write-write conflict is where two transactions try to write to the same record at the same time. That's also a conflict, it shouldn't be allowed. Okay? Any other interleaving where you don't have a read-write conflict or a write-write conflict is okay. If transactions are accessing mutually exclusive set of records, we don't care. Okay? If transactions don't only read records, that's fine. If two transactions are allowed to read the record at the same time, there's nothing like a read-read conflict you will see here. Okay. This is the same thing that a read-write lock will also give you, incidentally. It won't allow something to be read and written at the same time, or it won't allow two things to be written at the same time. Okay. So now, how do we implement this serializability in a transactional system? What is this scheduler thing that we have seen in the previous? What is this? What is it going to do to enforce serializability? That's what we need to understand. Okay. So first we'll talk about what is called optimistic concurrency control. Okay. So optimistic concurrency control basically implements serializability without using any locks. There are no locks in the system at all. So nothing to acquire, nothing to release. Okay. So what it does is, it basically, the reason it's called optimistic is it takes an optimistic view of the system. An optimistic view assumes that the conflicts are going to be rare. Okay. Let's not try to deal with them beforehand by grabbing locks. Let's try to deal with them after they have occurred. Okay. And if conflicts are indeed rare, okay, and they only occur once in a while, and you don't try to worry about them beforehand and you don't worry about locks, then you are going to get higher efficiency from the system, as we will see. Okay? So in this case, what happens is each transaction executes as it wants. Okay? It doesn't have to grab any locks, no release, nothing. It just starts executing, and before it's time to commit, what you check is, did some other transaction make a conflicting operation? Have I read or written something that some other transaction also wrote? If you detect that while I was executing, while this transaction was executing, some other transaction actually did something that triggers a read-write conflict or a write-write conflict, then you say, okay, now I cannot let this transaction commit. Because had I actually grabbed a lock before I did this, then this conflict wouldn't have even arisen in the first place. Because there are no locks, you have to check, saying, were there the conflict? If so, then you abort the transaction. So basically, you check if files or objects have been modified by some other committed transaction since this transaction started executing. And if you do detect a conflict, okay, then you will abort. Okay, so the insiders, conflicts are rare. And if conflicts are rare, then why bother with this overhead of having a lock and acquiring it and adding all this overhead? Let's just ignore all of that. So as you can imagine, this works very well with private workspace. This is very easy to implement with a private workspace. Before a transaction begins, you make a logical copy of the whole database, give it to this transaction. Transaction goes, modifies its local copy. Before it commits, you see, these are the records I modified. Did some other transaction either read my modified record or have I read something that somebody else modified? If so, there is a conflict. And rollback is as simple as I just throw away this workspace. There's nothing to do. Okay, because in reality, if this is my own copy and nobody else knows about it, I just delete it. The transaction is rolled back. Okay. So this whole notion of concurrency control, you can implement without any locks whatsoever. All you need to do is at commit time, at end transaction time, you check, are there conflicts in the system since I began? If so, then transaction has to be aborted. What are the advantages of this? You will get maximum parallelism. Okay, because there are no locks, every transaction gets to run immediately. No waiting, no blocking of any sort. Okay. So very high throughput can be achieved from the system because every transaction can run as soon as it begins. Okay. This is deadlock free. Okay, this is optimistic concurrency control is guaranteed to be free of deadlocks. Why is that? No locks, so why will there be a deadlock? So a deadlock free because there are no locks. Okay? Disadvantage. Disadvantage is you may have to do extra work. Okay? You may have to read on a transaction if it aborts. Okay? Because if you had grabbed a lock, you could have avoided this, but you didn't, so now there's a conflict. So you have to throw away all the work you did and restart. Okay? If there's this is a long transaction that did lots of computation, then you have to essentially throw it away and restart. Okay? And then the other disadvantage is the probability of conflict rises as the load on the system also increases. Okay? As there is more and more concurrency, as there are more and more transactions that execute in parallel, the probability that some transaction will actually touch a record that you have also touched and trigger a conflict also increases. Okay? So at high loads, the probability of having a conflict increases. Okay? And so does the probability of aborting transactions. So what this is also saying is as the load on the system rises, the amount of useful work that you are going to do actually might go down because more and more transactions start aborting and then all of that is wasted work. So you are doing a lot of work running transactions aborting them and you restart. Then you again run it, something, some other conflict arrives, you again throw it away, okay, all of those changes and keep doing this work. Okay. That's not a desirable property. As the load increases, you don't want to actually do more wasteful work. Yeah, because resources are scarce. You want to use those resources judiciously rather than just starting transaction, aborting them and then further increasing the load because each transaction has to run several times before it might succeed. Okay. So because of this particular disadvantage, although this is a very simple way of implementing any concurrency control system, no commercially available system actually implements concurrency control. Okay? All of them implement what is called pessimistic concurrency control, where you actually have locks. We look at those as well. Okay? There's this last point that although this looks very simple, it's nice, it's elegant, it gives you high parallelism, no real system implements it. And the reason is, if you are actually, let's say, a vendor of a database, okay, you don't want to tell your customer saying as your load increases, the amount of useful work you are going to do is decreasing. Okay? No customer will want to buy such a product. As the load increases, you want to actually use your resources in a judicious way and make sure you get maximum done rather than having this problem. So as a result of this disadvantage alone, so there has been a large amount of work that has gone into optimistic concurrency control. None of that is actually implemented in most commercial systems. Yes, question there.
Would it be possible to have a sort of hybrid system that switches between optimistic and pessimistic based on the load?
Yes, question is, can you actually have a combination that switches between optimistic and pessimistic? Certainly you can do that. But you will need a way to switch over where there is, you basically have to pause the system, let all the transactions finish and then switch. Okay. One could certainly do that. But the point here is really, if you think about it, what is pessimistic concurrency control? It implements concurrency control using locking. Okay. Locking adds overhead. This is precisely the overhead you want to avoid at high loads. Okay. I mean, pessimistic concurrency control doesn't have this property, but it further increases the load on the system because you have to have multiple lock acquires and release. Those are extra operations. Okay. Somehow at high loads you want to reduce the overhead of a transaction, not increase it. But what this is showing is if you try to reduce it, the goodput of your system can actually go down. Okay, so you basically don't have a good choice. You have two basically bad choices essentially at high load. Either you increase the overhead further by employing locking, avoiding this problem, but in having another problem, it says I have now locking overhead to deal with. Or you basically avoid locks and then you do wasteful work. So you basically have to choose between two not so great choices at high loads. Because you don't want pessimistic, at low loads, pessimistic concurrency control is okay because you have the resources to spare and get locks. So you could do hybrid, but it will not actually really solve the problem. Okay. So that's optimistic concurrency control. So here is a mechanism which is sort of falls in this category of pessimistic concurrency control. So here we will actually use locking to implement serializability. Okay. In particular, we'll use a protocol called two-phase locking. Okay. It's called 2PL in short. So this is a widely used concurrency control mechanism. Okay, many transactional systems use two-phase locking or some variant thereof. So what happens in this case is the scheduler that we saw in the previous slides, it is going to acquire locks in what is called a growing phase as you start touching new records. Okay, every time you touch a new record that you haven't touched already, you will get another lock. So you have this sequence of growing number of locks you keep acquiring. Okay. And then once you are done with the record and you are not going to do anything with this record in the rest of the transaction, you can start releasing locks. Saying, I am done with this record, so I release lock. So you have a scheduler that has basically two phases. Okay. That is why you have this what's called two-phase locking. You have a growing phase where you keep acquiring, and as you acquire, you don't release anything. You just keep acquiring. And once you start releasing, you cannot acquire anymore. You can only release. Okay. So I will show you your picture here of what is happening. So this is time. This is the number of locks that a transaction holds, okay, over its lifetime. Okay. So as it touches each new record, you basically keep acquiring locks. Okay. This is the growing phase within the schedule. Okay. At some point, okay, you know that there are no more new records you are going to touch. You are only going to keep doing operations on records on which you already hold locks. At this point, you can start releasing locks once you are done with each record. Okay, so you basically keep releasing these locks. Okay. This is the shrinking phase of your two-phase locking protocol. Okay. Is this clear what is happening? Now, I haven't said anything about which lock to acquire, in what order to acquire. I'm just explaining a basic concept of what two-phase locking does. Okay. Now, when do you actually get hold of a lock and so on? So what you do is whenever you try to access a data item, you basically check if this is the first time you are accessing data item X, and then you see what mode do you want to access data item X, and then you get either a read or a write lock on it. Okay. If there is a conflict, which means some other transaction already holds the lock, then you are going to delay, which means this transaction is going to block. Okay. It's not going to proceed, it's not going to execute until you get a lock. Okay. Otherwise, you grant a lock on that and the transaction continues. Okay. The point is you should never release a lock until the data manager finishes modifying record X. This is self-explanatory. Once you grab a lock, you wait until you are done with all the changes you want to do on X before you release a lock on X. Yeah? And once a lock is released, no further locks are granted. The reason this is done is there are some properties you can prove if you actually acquire and release locks in this growing and shrinking phase. You can prove some properties about deadlocks. Okay, what you want to avoid with all of this is deadlocks. Okay. Now, if deadlock is still possible in two-phase locking, if you don't pay careful attention to the order in which you are even acquiring locks. Okay, first you want to make sure that you have a growing and shrinking phase. Even if you have growing and shrinking phase, if you acquire locks out of order, okay, you could have deadlocks. Okay, a very simple example is, let's say there are two transactions, T1 and T2. Okay, so you have your begin transaction and your end transaction. So you say, so you want to acquire lock on A, acquire lock on B. So this is my growing phase and this is shrinking. So here if you do acquire B, and then you do release A and release B. Okay. Simple example, two transactions, okay, that are accessing two records, A and B. Okay. This one accesses A first and then B, so it grabs a lock on A first and then B. This one acquires a lock on B first and then it tries to grab a lock on A. Okay. This should be clear that this can result in a deadlock because this transaction may succeed, okay, in getting A. And because these are running in parallel, okay, you may actually now execute this statement which acquires a lock on B. Okay. Now this transaction holds a lock on A, that transaction holds a lock on B. Then you come here and you try to acquire a lock on B, which is in use, so you will block. Okay. This transaction now executes this statement which tries to grab a lock on A, which is in use, and now T2 blocks. Okay, now you have a deadlock. Because T1 is waiting for T2 to release a lock, T2 is waiting on T1 to release a lock. Okay, both of them will wait forever. Okay. So even though we actually had this growing and shrinking phase, which is what two-phase locking allows us to do, unless you also additionally pay attention to the order in which you acquire and release locks, you could have deadlocks in your system. Okay, is that clear? Now there are ways to avoid this deadlock, and that is by imposing an ordering of how you acquire locks. Okay, so in particular, if you, the simplest thing is if each record is given a record ID. Okay, so let's assume that's your database, these are individual records, you just number the records. Okay, if you always acquire locks in increasing order of records, okay, you are guaranteed there will not be a deadlock. Okay, so for instance, if these two transactions access A and B, okay, and let's say this is record A, this is record B, what you are imposing is regardless of in what order you access A and B, the order of acquiring locks is actually first A and then B. Okay, so now basically what this does is this causes this to acquire lock in that order. Okay, so this transactional system actually has to look at the entire transaction, see that you are accessing A and B. Okay. Even though you may be accessing B before A, notice I need two locks, A and B. Okay. And this system has imposed an ordering saying if you want these locks, you basically acquire them in increasing order. So even though you access B first within that transaction, you first have to grab a lock on A before you request a lock on B. Now this is a transaction fee. Regardless of the interleaving here, it's guaranteed you will never have a deadlock in this case. Okay. Because what will happen is if this transaction executes first, it acquires lock A. And then when this transaction acquires, it will block here at the beginning. It won't even start until this transaction is done and that gets to go. Okay. And vice versa, if this starts first and it gets a lock on A and this starts, then it will block immediately. Okay. So what this is showing is not only do you need this growing and shrinking phase, you also want to ensure some ordering, okay, if you want to prevent deadlocks in your system. So here is a simple extension of two-phase locking. It's called strict two-phase locking. Here also you have a growing and shrinking phase. But in the shrinking phase, you basically, what you do is you just release all the locks at once at end transaction time. You don't have this locks that are being released at one at a time. You get all the locks you want, okay? And then you wait until the transaction end and you just release it. It simplifies the implementation of your transactional system, because you no longer have to keep track of, am I done with X? Okay? Once you grab lock, you just wait. You keep the lock until the transaction itself is done. At that point, you know you are done with all the data items, you release all the locks. Okay? So this is two-phase locking. Yes, question back.
I guess I'm not sure I understand what property this gives you that's so desirable, like by not allowing you to grab any more locks after you've released the lock.
Okay. So, question is, what property does it give you? If you actually implement an ordering and implement a growing and shrinking phase, you can reason about the system and say that you can actually not have deadlock. If you have arbitrary nestings of when you can have lock acquires and lock releases, okay, it is not possible for the scheduler to know whether a deadlock will occur or not. You will have to actually analyze a transaction, and you could have arbitrary ordering of statements, arbitrary nesting, and then your transactional system becomes more complicated. So you are enforcing certain requirements in the system, so it's easier for you to implement a scheduler and be guaranteed. And if you just do this, there won't be any deadlock, and there's a property that tells you there is no deadlock. That's all. Otherwise, you did not have to impose a growing and a shrinking phase, but then the scheduler has to do extra analysis, saying, will this cause any problems down the road, and you have to do more complicated analysis. So this just simplifies the implementation. That's all. Any other questions? Okay. Now, I haven't shown, okay, just keep in mind that I just asserted here that you have growing and shrinking phase, you have an ordering, and there is no deadlock. I haven't proved that. Okay. And the reason is the proof is not trivial. It's quite involved. And there are papers I can make available if somebody really wants to know what the proof is. For the purposes of this course, we'll assume that this is a true property. Okay. We actually haven't proved it, but there's a real proof of this property. Okay, so that just quickly, before I move on to time, I guess I don't have time to talk about timestamp concurrency control, but what's the difference between strict and two-phase locking in terms of performance? Okay. So here all you're doing is you're waiting until the end to release the lock. Okay. This should tell you that strict two-phase locking will have lower concurrency than normal two-phase lock. The reason being, you hold locks for longer. You hold locks for longer, you can block someone else for longer. Okay. So this is basically a disadvantage of strict two-phase locking. That it will actually have lower concurrency in the transactional system, will have lower concurrency if you have strict 2PM or just normal 2PM. The advantage of strict two-phase locking is it simplifies the scheduler. Okay. The scheduler does not need to analyze the transaction and see, is this time for me to release a lock on X or Y or Z? The scheduler just asks, first time you access some data item, you just grab a lock, and once you have the lock, it will just wait until it sees an end transaction statement. It doesn't have to do anything. At that point, it will release all of its lock. So you basically have this trade-off between, is there more complexity in the scheduler, or do you have to actually want to simplify the scheduler but lose some performance? Okay, that's the trade-off between the two. In terms of properties, they are exactly identical. Okay, one is no better than the other in terms of sort of being deadlock free and so on. Okay, so that is strict 2PL. So let us I'll just introduce the notion of timestamps concurrency control and then I will stop. So the last pessimistic concurrency control mechanism, okay, does not actually use the notion of a lock per se, but it uses, goes back to the notion of logical clocks or Lamport's clock, and uses that to derive an ordering of events. So what happens is, every time a transaction starts in the system, you give it a timestamp. Okay, this could be a logical timestamp, but for the purposes here, doesn't matter. It could actually be a physical timestamp as well. So whenever TI, transaction I, wants to do an operation that conflicts with transaction J, you then check which transaction actually started first. If there's a newer transaction that started after you, that's gone ahead and modified some data item that now you want to access, then it is your job to terminate. Yeah, because the newer transaction already modified it, it's too late for you to do anything. You have to terminate because there's nothing you can do. So what you do is, whenever you detect a conflict, a read-read conflict or a read-write conflict, you compare the timestamp of this transaction with whoever actually caused that conflict. And then you abort the older transaction and you restart it with a newer timestamp. That's basically the thing. So when you are a transaction abort, it will start with a larger timestamp. So now the question then is, how do you detect whether a conflict occurs? To do that, you actually have to keep track for every record in your system. What was the latest transaction, newest transaction that's accessed it thus far? Okay. And that's called the max timestamp of a data item. So you have a timestamp for transactions, you have a timestamp for a record. So think of it as the last modified time of every record. Okay. So whenever you access a record, you check, when did I start? When was this record last modified? If this record was modified after I have started, okay, this means that some transaction has come and modified it already. Okay. That means there is a potential conflict, because if I go and modify it now, then I have a read-write conflict or a write-write conflict. So it's better for me to abort and then restart at a later. Only if the record actually has a time, last modified time, that is earlier than when I began, that means nobody has accessed it after I began. Yeah, because that's what last modified time is. It means it was modified sometime long time back. I began, nobody is accessing it now, so nobody is interested in this. There's no conflict. Right? So you use this notion of timestamps to detect whether there is a conflict in the system, and if so, you basically abort that transaction and restart. That's basically the point of timestamp concurrency control. Okay, next time I'll show what these two functions do, okay, but that's the basic idea. Okay, so let's stop here for today and come back and revisit this topic next time.